So without further ado, I'll let him tell his own story, and please give him a round of applause.
Thank you very, very much, and thank you very much for having me here. It's really, it's a huge privilege to be here. It really is. It's a bit of a dream come true for my father, who's sadly not here, because my father, when I was 9 years old, he was desperate for me to get to Oxford, absolutely desperate. So he brought me up here and he showed me around the various colleges to try and inspire me. And then he bought me the ultimate Oxford gift, which was a small brass anchor with a thermometer on it. That I kept that. It was the most tacky thing I've ever had, but I kept it for years and years. Sadly, I never made it to Oxford for reasons that will become clear, but it's really nice to be here, so thank you very much for having me. What I thought I ought to do before I go into exactly sort of various things I've been fortunate enough to be connected with is just give you a very short background on who I am, because then that helps put things in context, if you like. So just very brief background. I grew up on a farm in Somerset. I'm a huge disappointment to my mother, who wanted me to stay on a farm in Somerset, and I had some other ideas, so that didn't work out. I became a barrister, and then became a huge disappointment to my father by giving up being a barrister. Then I went and, I'm afraid, became one of the dreaded bankers, which is why I'm, I guess, here as one of those people who's done something sort of slightly alternative. My background, I'm very fortunate, I admit, many things put me in a very privileged position. I was lucky enough to be privately educated have a very good, just sort of generic background that kicked me off. My banking bit, which will come clear why it's sort of important in a while, bit of a strange story. I started in 1987 with a Japanese bank that was then the biggest bank in the world called Nomura. It was the time when, 1987, the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo and his gardens was worth more than the entire western seaboard of the United States. So it was one of those crazy bubbles. I mean, people forget, as they look at the economic situation today, is how historically we've had lots of very weird, strange bubbles. But that was one of them. And I joined Nomura during that time. I then, after 3 years at Nomura, decided to take what turned out initially was a good career move, and 18 years later was a very bad career move, by joining Lehman Brothers. After 18 years at Lehman Brothers, I was then at 2 o'clock in the morning on the opposite side of a negotiating table, because I was negotiating with Nomura, who were going to buy Lehman Brothers out of administration. At 2 o'clock on the Sunday morning, I was there opposite somebody called Sadek Saeed, who was the chairman then of Nomura. We did the deal, we shook hands, and he said, "Well, look, I'd like to invite you back. I'd like you to join the board at Nomura if you will come back." And I said, "Well, look, I've got a bit of news for you. I'm afraid 18 years ago I left, and two of your current board were told me at the time that I was never, ever to darken their doors again because the trust had been broken. So you may want to reconsider whether you really have me." But I've been back at Nomura for 3 years. Unfortunately, the Emperor's Palace is not worth what it was. Japan is not quite as interesting as it was, but it's still a fantastic place to be and a really interesting career. My sort of background in terms of the way of incorporating charitable work really started right at the beginning, and I think one of the great things about what you're doing is that if you don't start early on in life actually and develop a habit, and you don't have that habit right at the beginning, then it is very difficult to develop that habit later on in life, because the friends you make, the things you do out of hours, become different habits and they crowd in on your time, which is why I'm so passionate about doing things early on. One of the first things I did, which was while I in my early days at Lehman Brothers, and I did this together with my now wife, So I didn't have a previous wife. I've only had one wife. But the lady who became my wife set up a charity called BusinessWise. And I'd been in trouble at school. I may tell you over a glass of wine later on, but not now. Got in trouble at school, could easily have seen myself chucked out of that school, and realised that a lot of people who were being chucked out of school were actually extremely bright. And the reason they were being chucked out was because they were bright and they were just, quite frankly, bored. Having been to the States and see how some people there dealt with the problem, ended up setting up a charity here, which was basically taking all of the kids who the councils were taking out of the state system and teaching them on an 80-hour course how to set up and run their own businesses. And it had a fantastic success rate, still does, at around 20-25% of people coming out of the course then over the next 2 years do actually continue to run their own business, which is great. I mean, when I say run their own business, you know, we're literally talking market stalls and things like that, but at least they're doing something which they're able to attach their minds to. So that was the first thing. Where that came from, by the way, and often when I talk with my children about, you know, why I do what I do, it's interesting. For me, doing charitable work actually comes from anger. And this is going to become clear when I go on to talk about the Balance Foundation and the assets that got moved into the charitable sector there. But I think anger is a really good place to start. If you're angry about something, in fact, I suppose for those Latin scholars among you, you know, compassion, being passionate about something, it's to do with anger about a situation. And certainly I started off on in most of the charities that I've become involved in. It's really been as a result of a deep-seated anger about an injustice in a situation and then working within that situation to try and make it better. But let me come on to the sort of Balance Foundation story, if I can, and tell you a bit about that. I was completely exhausted. My fourth child had just been born. Sleepless nights were sort of continuous. I had been promoted to a managing director at the time, and I was sort of working all the hours that God gives, and was extremely tired. But again, at the end of a financial year, the Lehman Brothers board were approaching me and saying, every other bank is taking their unclaimed assets to their profit and loss account. We want you to authorise us taking the money that's sitting unclaimed in the system to our profit account. And on hearing that, I just got outright angry. So that was the sort of start thing. And I sat for the next few weeks thinking, right, this is just totally inappropriate. And I'd identified two of the other banks, British banks, again, I'm not going to say in front of the video, but tell you in a glass of wine which banks were taking the money to their own profit and loss account. And I'd refused to allow my board to do the same thing. And I thought, right, there has to be a better way around this. And then, as all good ideas tend to come in the bath, I was lying in the bath one day and thinking about it and thinking that really what was needed or what could happen with that money is that you could statistically calculate how often somebody would come and claim unclaimed assets, because banks keep records of every time somebody comes along. Well, if something is statistically capable of calculation, then you're able to estimate what it would cost to insure against somebody coming along and making that claim. And so we ran some figures. I got people at work to run some figures for me based upon the balances within the Lehman account. We worked out that basically the insurance premium would probably equate to around 4 or 5% of the total pot of assets. So the very simple idea was, okay, well, for every £100 that's unclaimed in the banking system, let's take £5 of that, buy an insurance policy, and then the other £95 can go to charity. And there were some sort of slightly complicated tweaks on it, but the next task that I had to do was sell it to the regulators. And I had initially a meeting with the Financial Services Authority, and I said, look, this is brilliant for consumers, because if the bank goes down, they're paid out of an insurance pool that is indefinite, so they don't create credit risk on the bank anymore, so they win. And it's brilliant for the charitable sector, because it gets money into the charitable sector. I then went along to the Bank of England. The Bank of England were wonderfully... they didn't think they were being positive, but actually they said the most positive thing they could have ever said, which was, oh my goodness, this is such a big solution. We've got to worry about the M1 money supply, because so much more cash will come into the economy as a result of you releasing up all of this. And I thought, oh, that's fantastic. I didn't envisage that much coming in, but that's brilliant. The next stage was then to... I was at a meeting. I was privileged enough to be at a meeting at the Bank of England. And I found in life you've sometimes got to follow hunches. We all have them from time to time, and I've got plenty of stories connected with other things I've done where I've had hunches and talked to other people. And I had a hunch at this meeting that I needed to talk to somebody across the table about the idea. His name was Martin Thomas. And so I went up to him and I said, you don't know me. You're obviously connected with the bank. I've got an idea. Can I take you for lunch? And I did that. Turned out it was just the best thing I could have possibly done because he knew somebody who had been employed by Lord Sainsbury to run a think tank within the Gatsby Trust. And Gatsby Foundation is a huge organisation, one of the major charities. And so I went along, I met with this lady called Susan Hitch, who actually, I think, does some things at Oxford, occasionally in the radio. She's one of these great polymaths. And Susan got very excited around the idea and said, oh, well, you've got to come and meet the Gatsby trustees and tell them about the idea. So I came down and talked to them. We'd run some calculations about how much unclaimed assets there were in the UK banking system, which was around, reckoned around 12 billion other people. It's lower than that, but as a total unclaimed asset pool, that's what it sort of looked like at the time, if you include banking, law firms, everything else. So I sat down with a PowerPoint presentation, and sorry, I haven't got one today. I hate PowerPoint presentations, so you've just got me sitting in a chair. Apologies. But it took a PowerPoint presentation, went through it. They had a load of academics sitting and sort of seven people around. It was very frightening. And they stopped me about 10 minutes in. I thought, I'm done, I'm toast. Somebody's spotted a weakness I just haven't thought of. They stopped me 10 minutes in. They said, can you step outside and come back? And so I did that. Came back in and they said, okay, where do you want your offices? How many staff do you want? And how much money do you want? I said, well, I haven't really come prepared for those sort of questions. Said, well, okay, well, how about a budget of 1 million? Will that do? And so, yes, thank you very much. And so I walked out of that office, having otherwise spent really very much otherwise an ordinary day turned into a extraordinary day. And I have to confess, walking down the street after having been at such an extraordinary meeting was the first time post my parents' divorce I burst into tears as I sort of walked down the street, because suddenly this dream was becoming a potential reality, and it was just a fantastic feeling and an amazing event. So to tell you just a little bit more about the story. From there, we were able to set up the office. So it was great. We had some great people working in the office and working on the project. As part and parcel of it, we really, next step was to get sort of all the banks involved. And being a senior banker, I was in a position to basically call in favours. So the first thing I did was get a dinner in one of our big dining rooms and called in all my friends who I thought had a heart for charity from all the major banks. And I said, right, this is what I'm intending to do. I need you to sell it to your boards if we're able to do it. We came up with project plan around it, everything else. We suddenly found actually the next big hurdle, they may not have regarded themselves as a hurdle, was actually government. Gordon Brown got to hear about it, and he suddenly realised, my goodness, this is a massive tax revenue stream for me. I shouldn't let this money go to charity. I should take it into the tax coffers. And there then ensued a massive battle, effectively. And forgive me for this bit, I don't mean it to sound like a name drop, but it was just, it's again where working in a charitable situation takes you into places that you would have never expected to be. So I really want to give you it as an example. So to try and deal with Gordon Brown, somebody put me in touch with the Prince of Wales's office, and I found myself with Sir Dom Shabir and Sir Michael Peat running down the stairs saying, oh, fantastic, you're the guy who's going to sort of put all this money into charity. Fantastic, what do we need to do for you? And so found myself wandering around and only to find out that the next Tuesday, Gordon Brown was meeting with Governor of the Bank of England at lunchtime and then was having dinner at the palace in the evening. And so we designed a pincer movement on him to try and prevent him taking the money for the tax man. And the pincer movement went basically as follows. My contacts I'd made from my initial meeting at the Bank of England agreed a same script as the Queen and Prince Charles agreed. And basically the script went, we hear you've already approved all of this money going into charity, and we'd like to congratulate you on backing such a noble cause. And Prince Charles had me write a letter, which he then signed and sent to Gordon Brown, basically documenting all of that following the dinner that they'd had on the Tuesday night. Gordon Brown had been intending on the Wednesday, this was on the Tuesday, on the Wednesday was the budget, and he had been planning on that budget meeting to say, we have now worked out a way of taking the unclaimed assets into tax. That shifted overnight as a result of the pincer movement, and we became the first charity ever to be officially launched as part of a budget speech, which was fantastic. So he twisted the speech around, he launched us officially as part of that speech, and we then went ahead developing the mechanism of getting this money into charity. It's difficult to keep running totals, but we think about between 180 and 200 million so far has gone into charity, which is great. There was a lot more that could have gone into charity. And the big commercial banks, because they were taking a lot of this money to profit and loss, held out, and held out in a major way. What that then morphed into is the announcements that you've seen around the Big Society Bank and the Green Bank. So the unclaimed assets then ended up becoming part of that scheme to help finance those banks and launch those banks. So that's what we, as the Balance Foundation that we originally set up, then became. It was a fantastic time, fantastic ride, and it did change things. And I'm very pleased to say that even today, we've got two other projects going on, which hopefully will come to the same place, one in Singapore and the other, which would be absolutely brilliant, but we're probably about a year and a half away, seeing whether it will really work in Switzerland. But if we crack Switzerland, that's just the dream come true, obviously. We'll see if we get there. The key takeaway I say to everyone, and I've set up in the banks I work for, I've got a big group, I call it Brains for Change, and I encourage everybody who works in the banks to think radically all the time about what they're doing in their day job, and could they make it in some way work for the better of society, for the better, rather like the Balance Foundation was able to do that. And certainly I find it's the way I constantly think. I've got two projects on the go at the minute. One, unfortunately, I can't say a lot about at the minute, but I promise to come back if the government adopts it. But it's a whole revolutionary way of dealing with the banker's bonus issue. And then the second scheme that's on the go at the minute is a scheme in relation to the way capital is allocated, how you use capital within the banking system to make banks do good. I know that sounds a strange thing, but banks have to put aside capital differently and large amounts of capital. And if banks are lending to corporates that are sustainable corporates, and this was my idea around it, and it's how you define sustainability. Sustainability, you can have economic sustainability in the sense that if the Milk Marketing Board is paying farmers 14 pence a litre when it costs them 16 pence a litre, that's not a sustainable business model. That just puts farmers out of business. Sustainability in terms of, obviously, environmental and other issues. But sustainability does not exist within the capital models within the banking system. So my latest project working with people in the Club of Rome is to try and get sustainability as part of the measure of capital. And then the capital relief comes into the banking system, and that will make it better for banks to always lend to companies who are running the sort of models that probably every one of us in this room would like to see them support, types of companies we'd like to see them supporting. I'll just give you a flavour of some of the other things I ended up with, and then what I wanted to do was just focus on some key sort of selling points as to why it really becomes good for you and your career, regardless of what you do, to weave charity into it right from the beginning. But let me tell you about just some other adventures, just in case you want to sort of talk about any of them. I then, after the Balance Foundation, I switched to something entirely different. Sorry, you'll realise I've got it. My mother always accused me of having a grasshopper brain, and by the end of this, you're going to realise that I really do have a grasshopper brain. So the next thing I got passionate about and angry about was actually within the Church of England. So completely different area. Saw the Church of England really going down two different paths, a charismatic part, which absolutely had no intellectual depth, or very little intellectual depth to it, and a part which was sort of fading away in the shires, that have really become the last thing, the last bastion. The village shop had gone, the pub had gone, and the church was the last thing remaining, but it wasn't really doing anything in terms of communicating what the church fathers were wanting to talk about, which includes things like how society should operate, everything else. So I set up a theological college called Westminster Theological College, which luckily got accreditation from the Church of England, and now tried to sort of revolutionise the way that you trained clergy, in the sense that it took clergy who couldn't afford to take a few years out, were already doing charitable work, a lot of them, and actually allowed them to learn part-time, but also provided, just like the magisterium does for the Catholic Church, a source of intellectual resource for them throughout their lives. So that was the next one. Lehman then collapsed, and I joined Nomura. Nomura didn't have a charity in a minute, which I just couldn't believe. So I made it a condition of joining Nomura that I was able to set up a charity. So we did that, and luckily got $4 or $5 million in sort of straight off the bat, which was great. And I've had great fun sort of running, being the founding trustees of the Nomura charity, and tell you about some of the mad things we get up to with that. Then one of the weirdest things ever, where life took a twist again, because you end up, as you start doing more charitable stuff, you meet other people and they network you in, and you end up in different places you never expected to be. So the next one is really off the wall. I got approached by Gilbert and George, the artists, to set up, basically look after their future when they die. It won't be a surprise to any of you who know Gilbert and George that they haven't got a lot of children to leave their art collection to. But Gilbert and George, who are so delightful, and it's a real privilege to work with them. In fact, tomorrow I'm with them sorting out things in relation to their art collection. But that became a passion because they've always worked in Fournier Street in the East End. They know how to integrate, and they're desperate to integrate what they do with their art together with helping people in that area of East End of London. So that's been my sort of latest diversion, if you like. So I just wanted to give you an idea of the types of flavours of things I do. Most important thing I wanted to do was talk about why 80,000 hours is such a good idea, and why it provides, I think, something quite essential for anybody's life, or having charity as part of your life is completely essential. I have to say, looking back on my life and the good days and the bad days, the bad days, I've definitely had two worst days. So certainly the worst day were obviously the day that Lehman collapsed, and I was one of 10 people in the office trying to prevent it collapsing. I obviously didn't do a very good job. That was a pretty bad day. But then on the Friday after that, I was asked by the Governor of the Bank of England to meet with the 250 people who were most affected, the stock exchanges, the clearing houses, the other banks, by the Lehman collapse, and be the Lehman representative in front of all this angry crowd of 250 chairmen from around the... And I remember sitting there, and it was Paul Tucker from a bank. I actually had lunch with him on Monday. I reminded him of the pain he put me through. Standing there in front of all these angry people and sort of thinking, what did I do wrong in life to end up sitting in this situation? Anyway, those are the bad days. The good days, I have to say, for me, it doesn't matter what deal I've been able to do, and I've done some of the most fascinating deals I really have. Worked, you know, on some incredible projects. None compares to the launches of a number of the charities. The launches of the charities and, you know, getting involved, going, seeing the kids come through the Business Wise program, seeing the money released out of the Balance Foundation, seeing the kids what we're going to do with the Gilbert and George Foundation, just seeing that. There is no day as good as that, trust me, I promise you. And do you know what? Often, to get through the rough days, we need to remember the good days. So, which leads me to one of the main things is, I know you won't believe it. You absolutely won't believe it. But no matter how amazing a job you go into, in my view, there will be lots of days when you say life is dull. Because the truth is, you will master your profession. And you will get to a stage where actually it feels like routine. I reckon even if you ask some of the, you know, great... I'm fortunate enough to know a great pianist, you know, and a great musician, great artist, anyone else, any profession where you think, I would really like to be that person because it's an extraordinary thing to go into. They have dull days, let me... trust me on that. What working within the charity sector does is you carry that through your days with you, because you're getting phone calls during the day, which is suddenly somebody saying, oh, look, Piers, I've had this idea, I know you know X, what about doing Y? I'll give you an example tomorrow. So yesterday happened to me, a great hero of mine, who nobody will have heard of, is somebody called Peter Sherratt, who had tea with yesterday. He set up something called CAMFED, which he chairs. It's educated 2 million girls in Africa. It's a huge organisation with the belief that the way that Africa will transform itself is through the education of the women there. Amazing organisation, amazing what he's done. He's a banker as well, or was until about a year and a half ago. And sitting there with Peter, he's talking about the girls getting to the end of their careers and their education, and the problem is there is no work. I've got, meanwhile, the business-wise thing, and I've got another friend who wants to do charity work who set up a company called New Media Spark, which was a very famous dot-com company, setting up a fund for $80 million to invest in new business in Africa. So last night I said, right, okay, Andy, this is Peter. Peter, this is Andy. We're going to meet next week, see if we can get some of the $80 million into then seed funding the girls coming out of the CAMFED program. And that took up half an hour of a day yesterday, but I have to say was the most exciting part of yesterday. And you find that there's bits in an otherwise dull, monotonous day where your involvement in charities and your connection with other people really carry you through those days. I love my job, by the way. I don't mean I have a dull job. I do really enjoy it, but as with any job, it has its monotonous moments. The second thing that why I'd emphasise something like 80,000 hours and going down the charitable route right from the beginning is fantastic, is it takes you down places that you would never dream that your life would otherwise take you. I would have never dreamt I was going to be, you know, wandering around St. James's Palace drafting letters for Prince Charles. Just never in my wildest dreams, from a farm in Somerset, would I ever dream that. Equally, I never dreamed that I'd have ended up, and it's equal privilege, you know, wandering off with Gilbert and George once a month to their favourite restaurant up in Hackney. Charity leads you into places and people, and leads you also to alongside, you know, other people who are benefiting from it that you would just never otherwise do in your normal daily routine. So you end up breaking the patterns of what might otherwise be quite a routine life. The other, even more important thing it does, in terms of those of you who are thinking about taking a career where you're going into the commercial sector or anywhere else, I'm now sort of fast approaching 50. I've watched enough people going through particularly the banking system to see where it goes wrong and where people fail in their careers. And I can tell you that I'm very strongly of the view that the one thing that causes people to fail in their careers is pride. Everybody gets looked over from time to time. Everybody doesn't get paid what they believe they deserve to be paid at some point in time. Everybody feels that somebody else shouldn't be in a position that they're in because they're a village idiot and how on earth did they get there? What pride does is then cause people to just overreact, throw in the towel and give up on the career then and there, even if it's something they love doing. If you're spending a lot of your day thinking about people in a far worse position than you, and if a lot of what you're earning is going to look after people who are in a lot of a worse position than you, pride just doesn't enter into it in the same way. And it's been interesting to watch as I've luckily and, you know, by a twist of fate, ended up getting more senior within the groups that I've been in. So I've realised that as I look round the boardroom that I'm in, virtually everybody is hugely involved in charity who got there. and sat down with one of them recently, and we were comparing notes, and it was actually the pride element that came out. We reckoned that most people, when they got to a mid-management level, ended up self-destructing at some point, and that it was quite often the involvement with a charity and people therefore being a little more humble and therefore more prepared to take the knocks that are bound to come your way, that actually enable people to ride through those tough periods and keep their career going. I think the other thing, if I was to be totally merciless about it, I promise you this is not why I do it, is it massively enhances your career as well. So for me, because it opened, let me give you a few examples, and again, please forgive me, it isn't meant as a sort of name drop thing, but through the various charities I've been involved with, I end up sitting with the heads of the Bank of England or the heads of the FSA. Okay, they're sitting with me thinking, oh no, not another mad cat scene, but at least I've got FaceTime with them. And so when people with the bank come say, okay, and then another one that happened last year, so as a result of something through the Bank of England, when the Lord Mayor last year, a nice guy called Michael Baer, wanted to run his fundraising, he kindly asked me to do it, and we were able to raise about 22 million at that time. So that got me into the sort of via the Lord Mayor's office connected there. And so career-wise, it's actually ended up feeding back, because now my bosses in Japan, when they want to get into the Treasury or want to get into the Bank of England or want to get in to see the Lord Mayor or whatever, they say, oh, well, Piers, he knows those people, and they tend to pick up the phone from him. And so it's ended up very strangely, in this sort of strange way, a number of the projects have ended up coming back in such a way that actually it's helped my own career in a way that I certainly would have never anticipated. And you can see that, do you know what, you see that as well at a top level. You see the way the newspapers distinguish in my area. It's going to be very controversial on the screen, between two different types of banking heads. He's been a banker all his life, but he's been a banker who's tried to connect with society throughout it all, and luckily that's kind of recognised. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you've got some bankers who definitely are in it for a very large bonus numbers, and they're, you know, I suppose their attitude or the public perception of their attitude is being reflected and then limiting their own careers. The other thing charity does is it connects you within, regardless of which workplace you go into, say you go to work for ICI, so you go work for anything else, it connects you within work fantastically well. I remember the guy, John Harvey Jones, that was his name. Sorry, I'm showing my age here, of a different generation, you remember him. John Harvey Jones, he became chairman of the ICI, and he was asked when he became chairman of ICI, well, how on earth did you do it? Because he became chairman very, very quickly, rose through the ranks. And he said, I'm very, very fortunate. I did it because I've got lots of friends in low places. In other words, he knew all the guys who, from the from people doing the coffee all the way through the car park, he built up a reputation within the firm. If you do end up with a career where, you know, you are going up through the ranks, charity within the company connects you in places where you'd never expect it to take you. So by way of example, 4 weeks ago, I was with a load of people from our operations department, completely different. They were all in their 20s, and I was upside down. There's a photo. Luckily, this is why I didn't bring a PowerPoint, of me upside down in a cave in Cheddar Gorge, sort of hanging upside down, doing this caving for charity on something we call the Nomura Challenge, where we you end up with groups of people, because you're involved in charity, that you would never otherwise be involved with. And that gives you great variety. It gets you connected within the workplace, and it gives, again, another meaning while you're at a job which is ostensibly not a, a job that's a charity in itself, but it could be a bank or ICI or anything else. And it brings you, as a result of that, across some really fantastic like-minded people, because you suddenly find, oh my goodness, in this office of 3,000 people, there's at least 400 people who are also passionate about doing things for charity. And that means when you come through the door and you see people walking down the corridor, you've got a connection with other people that sparks ideas, that makes you feel doubly good about being there, etc. So again, it sort of enhances your reason to do what you're doing. I'm now going to use a strange one, and this again is just because of my age. And another reason that I think 80,000 hours is fascinating, but it's only become clear to me now, having four children, and that's actually in family life. If I always came back home, and what my children knew of me was my banking existence and my expertise in complex equity derivatives, I would have a very short relationship with each of my children. What being connected with charity enables me to do, which again was just a massive side benefit, is I'll often come home, I will do tomorrow night, with messages to them all from Gilbert and George and what we're going to do with the foundation there and etc. I'll come back to them from the caves down in Cheddar Gorge or whatever, with pictures of their ridiculous overweight father trying to get through a thin crack in the cliffs. It ends up, the involvement in charities has ended up creating a network for us as a family. And we're beginning also to send the children out over the next few years to some of the charitable projects we've got running in the Stans and in Africa, so that part of their lives then becomes part of mine and my wife's life. And it's created a dimension there that was is really rich in terms of a seam through our family life. I then sort of finally, in terms of sort of summary of why I think it's so critical and so important, and again I'm doing my old man of the hill bit here, so as I've watched those around me getting older and even the generation above, what I've realised happens to all of us, whether we like it or not, is as far as I'm concerned, we become caricatures of ourselves. We become more extreme characters of who we were in our 20s and 30s and 40s. And that then really begins to show through at a particular stage. And maybe some of you can think about your own parents and whether they've become slightly more caricatures of themselves. Certainly mine have. And your weak, the foibles become bigger foibles and everything else. But you very much, I then see people who throughout their lives have done charitable work and have woven charity into their existences. And I have to say, meeting them, just, it doesn't matter what background they're from or what they've done, the light in their eyes, the care in their hearts, and the character that they've ended up becoming as a result of being involved over time, has really a marked change from other people who've perhaps not woven that in. And the problem is you need to weave it in from quite early on, because there's so many distractions in life. And if you don't start, there's no right time. It's like having children, which we did very early on because we were bad at reading instructions, but that's another story. But there is no right time for these things. So you've just got to get on with it early enough. Weave it into your lives from an early stage. It then will begin to form who you are, and it will then create all these other networks, and it grows, as I say, over time. And apart from anything, guess what? You're all, at some stage, going to retire as well, or semi-retire. Again, the people that I've come across that are happiest in retirement are those who effectively didn't retire. It's just the charitable side of their life took over from the work, the commercial work side of their life. And it was just a very natural transition. It just morphed from one stage into the other. Then lastly, my last selling point as to why 80,000 hours is as well spent is confidence. One of the reasons I became a lawyer is that I thought I could be in an oak-panelled room and wouldn't need to talk to anyone because growing up on the farm was all well and good, but actually there weren't many people to talk to and you became a little bit introverted and shy. You end up, through your charity work, gaining a huge amount of confidence. And so when I had the recent idea on how to change the capital system within the banking community, I don't sleep very well, I'm a bit of an insomniac, I'd heard the head of the Club of Rome talking about the problems of the corporate capitalist system and how it didn't lead towards sustainability. I picked up the phone to him the next day and called him and I said, I think I've got a solution for you. Now, if I hadn't gone through a series of sort of charitable enterprises before, I'd have never had that confidence to pick up the phone and do something that otherwise I'd have thought, I'm just going to make a total idiot out of myself. So that's kind of it in summary. What I wanted to do was give you really mercenary reasons why it's in your own absolute self-interest, away from the good that you will completely do. So I haven't talked about the knock-on good, you know, the lives that you will impact through the charitable work, because you'll hear that all the time from other charities that are talking to you. I really wanted to say that for me, as one of the dreaded bankers, it has been just the most extraordinary, what started out as an adjunct to life, but is now a very sort of central part of life, and has made a complete difference. And I'm sure it would with everybody else in terms of what you do. And if you're passionate about what you do, and hopefully you'll go into a job about whatever makes you excited about life, and then what you will do in that job, if you're also passionate about charity, is find ways of weaving those two together, just as the Balance Foundation was able to. So with that, I'll shut up and take any questions.
So I've just suggested a couple of questions, and then we've got lots of drinks in the other room, so we should move rapidly into
that. Sounds good to me.
Really good questions now, to say that.
First, thank you very much for a very inspiring talk. I was just wondering, obviously, within the banking industry, there's a lot of the attitudes of people. How did your colleagues initially respond to your sort of inklings of spending a lot of time, it seems, in charity? And then you touched upon how you were curious, but before it was beneficial to them, how did you sort of deal with that?
It's a really good question. And there were very diverse reactions, I have to admit. First of all, luckily I had the man Peter Sherratt, who I mentioned, who'd set up CamFed, as my immediate boss at Lehman Brothers. So I had a lot of air cover from him. When I came up with the Balance Foundation idea, though, it almost split the bank, in that half of the bank, including I better not name them, but some very, very senior people, said, OK, you are going to ruin Lehman's reputation among all its banking counterparts, because what you're going to do is stop them taking this money to their profit account, and they're not going to live without. And we, Lehman, cannot back the launch of this. I went, in order to counteract that, I went to a friend who is very brave, and was then the deputy chairman at UBS. And I said, mind banks wavering on this. UBS is renowned as one of the Swiss banks. I need your support. Will you stick your neck out and be part of the launch? And he did. Incredible guts, real guts. And he got really criticised by his management for having done it. But as soon as he was prepared to do it, and then my bosses at Lehman knew that UBS was about to take the glory that should be Lehman glory, they became sufficiently jealous, for want of a better word, to say, no, we need the Lehman brand behind this. If we can't have UBS taking the glory. It was kind of your idea. It was then interesting how it played out in a different way. So again, in the organisation, after that, they tried to give me a big bonus for having done it, which I said, look, you've totally missed the point. This was not about Lehman branding. and so that showed another side of them. I thought, why am I having this conversation? So I said, look, allow me to give that to a charity, chosen cause of a charity. This is not about making money for the organisation. And I think something like that, it did show the two sides of the industry, and there are definitely two streams within the banking industry. And the people, you know them. It's like, you know, friends in college or anything else. You kind of know the warm-hearted people and the less warm-hearted people. It doesn't take long to identify them, but certainly through schemes like that it becomes pretty clear. The joy of this crisis and my hope with this crisis that the banking industry is going through, that those who are in it just for the money will fall out. That as the overall compensation goes down 20-30%, etc. And that those with genuinely good ideas about how to reconnect banks and society and other things are actually now having a voice that they didn't previously have, because the voice was previously dominated by the bottom line and the returns. So I'm quite hopeful for the industry at the minute. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, so thanks again for what's really an amazing success story. A particularly good example of what we often refer to as leverage, where you can just do this one thing and then it has, this one change to the way unclaimed assets are processed, and it's this huge benefit, $200 million going to the charity. And what I was wondering is, there will be many people in the room kind of aspiring to that sort of success. And I was wondering if you can have a kind of honest assessment of why you think you've managed to achieve that. So, I know obviously you want to be modest, but do you think it's things like luck? Do you think it was being particularly strategic or goal-oriented? Do you think it was the fact that you had this sort of ethical passion, whereas maybe your colleagues didn't? Do you think it was your intelligence or ability to network? What do you think were the kind of decisive attributes that singled you out other people might
have
to do the same thing?
So just how immodest can I be?
Yeah, exactly.
I think, first of all, it does come about what your mind time, how you use your mind. I think if you use your mind time for in genuine ways to try and make something better than it is. And it comes back to the anger point, that you're angry about a situation, you see it, and you attach your mind to, can I make it better? Then I think that has to exist, which is why I don't think anybody in their career should do anything that they're not passionate about, because I think it's the anger. If they're passionate about what they're doing, whether it's cooking or anything else, they can convert that into something that's for good. Whether it's Jamie Oliver doing his school dinners or whatever, you can, if you're passionate about something, then that will develop an anger where you see it not working that will then result in you bringing about change for better. So I think the starting point key was I actually did something I felt very strongly about as a career. In that I to this day I feel that actually a lot of good can be done. I know it's a radical thing to say these days by finance if it's allocated in the right way. So I think being in an area that, whereas if you're in a job that you're just actually you're treading water and you're just finding dull, you're not probably going to then start finding yourself in situations where you want to bring about change in it, or you're less likely to. So I think that's the first key. I think the second key is probably just being slightly naive. and just trust your instinct. If I hadn't gone across the table to speak to Martin Thomas, even though I was tired, I don't think I'd slept much. I think our youngest had been up most of the night. But if I hadn't gone across, and suddenly when you reach out like that, if you've reached out to the right person, then it takes on a momentum of itself. You actually get carried along by everyone else, because they then come and join with you. They get excited about it. And suddenly, actually, it doesn't become your effort. And the way I would describe it, a lot of what was going on at that time is, because I was still working very hard in the day job, is that life almost becomes a film in front of you. It's almost in a wave that sort of carries you along. And it's just basically because you're lucky enough to have the right people around you at the time. So there is that. I think timing is huge with the idea. You can't have the right idea at the wrong time. It's just not going to go, not going to go anywhere. And then I think position as well. I think I was hugely fortunate. I was already general counsel of Lehman Brothers in Europe, which gave me connections in the FSA, in the bank, and in the other banks. Around the city, which meant I could walk through doors. And I think it would have been very difficult had I not had that position. So I think it was probably those three things. Plus a whole load of other stuff. You know, I'm very lucky. I've got a very good... If I think about other lives as well, you know, there's very simple things like basically having a really good marriage. Well, that means I don't have to go home and worry every day about other things going on or other things collapsing, and that then frees up the mind to do the other projects you've got. And I don't think you can... So there's a lot of other things that people might say are minor things, but actually then create, through their foundations, a huge amount of strength that then enables you to spend time doing things like that. Sorry for this. Oh, gosh, sorry. Just one more. There's five hands. Shall I go for the lady? Sorry, yes.
You mentioned about the day job and kind of your charity work on the side, which you mentioned has kind of become the core of your career in a way, and about how the time can be a really good opportunity to focus on that. Is there anything to be said for kind of starting off focusing fully on charity work? I mean, would you say that it's more beneficial to go into a kind of high-powered career where you can do more good, if that makes sense?
Yeah. I know there's a lot of debate about this at the time, and I know there will be some very learned books written on the subject, probably. And pamphlets written on it. For me, it comes down to the passion point, to the compassion point and the anger point. I believe that anybody should do what is driving and motivating them the most. And if that means going into Africa and teaching in a school in Africa, then you should do that and should try that. On the other hand, if somebody is also, if you've got that as a passion and you're also particularly brilliant at engineering, my point is you can combine the two. So Peter Sherratt, with his 2 million girls through education, private education in Africa, is... he didn't just fund it. He set it up. It's now largely funded by Google and who's his latest funder. But it's a sort of 22 million. It's obviously this budget now is just over £22 million. But he was passionate about education. He was brilliant in finance. He chose to go in finance, but he's done something extraordinary in education. But I don't think it's any good somebody going in to banking if they're not passionate about it, thinking that then they're going to put the money into education, because A, you're going to ruin your heart because you're doing something you don't actually enjoy, and that's not a good move in life. B, you won't actually do well at it, so you won't generate the money to educate the people you're wanting to, and you won't get up far enough up the tree to be able to create the influence. So I think both routes are equally valid, and you can achieve the same ends. But I think if you're, want a better term, if your gift is engineering, or your gift is cooking, and that's what you really are passionate about, but you're also very concerned about education, I would say think very hard before just doing the education in Africa. Think about potentially doing going down the route you're passionate around, but connecting in with the education in Africa and saying, okay, I'm passionate about cooking, I'm therefore going to work out how I, in addition to doing what I'm doing, create sustainable meals across various schools in Africa that wouldn't otherwise be possible, and how do we do that, and how do you create a sort of sustainable microeconomy around feeding people.